Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. So over here with me in New York is journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there.
Hello. We're having to cuddle together so we can both listen on the same headphones. It's pretty ridiculous. And back in the studio, you guys, the band's back together. It's Oliver Wang.
Yes, thank you. Back from the dead.
Lovely to have you back. And with a new spring approach to her hair, it's Winter Mitchell.
Yes. Loving the coif.
I killing love it. That look.
Every week we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week I want you guys to tell me, what's the first album you bought with your own money as a child or teen? Margaret, since we're physically touching right now, why don't you start?
Well, let me answer your question, my Siamese twin. I bought Hot Rocks by the Rolling Stones with my money when I was about sixth grade. I was vacationing in upstate New York with my uncle, and we went into this classic like college record store, and I bought Hot Rocks because I got really obsessed with Under My Thumb that summer, and it just blew it all open for me. I mean, ever since then, I've been a huge Rolling Stones fan.
Winnie, what was your first album?
Doggy Style by Snoop Dogg. Which I don't even know if that qualifies, because I had to return it once my mom saw the cover of the CD.
One of the worst covers of all time.
One of the worst covers of all time. His homie made it. You know that's what happened. And that actually became the trend for covers, CD covers. But yeah, I was obsessed with Snoop Dogg as soon as he came out, knew every single word to every single song. And then I saved up my lunch money for 2 days, ate everybody else's lunch, and then went to Tower Records and bought it. Listened to it. My mom heard it from upstairs, and then she came downstairs and says, "What are you playing?" And my mom's not even a prude. And then I said, "Oh, I'm playing this." And then I was like, "You like him?" I tried to like reverse psychology with her, because I was like, "It has
gin
all these
juice. That's your jam."
No, but I was like, "It has all these songs. It samples all these songs you used to party to." Oh, she didn't give a shit. No. She made me return it like the next day.
Ain't no fun.
Oliver, what about you?
It was Art of Noise's Invisible Silence, and I bought it from, I think it was it Penny Lane Records? It was a record store that used to be right off of Venice Beach in that little kind of old quad area, and I liked, they did a version of Peter Gunn, which I didn't realize was, you know, like an older song, but I used to listen to it on K-Rock, and I really liked it. And for whatever reason, I was in Venice, because I didn't live out in the West Side back then. This would have been probably 86, 87. And I bought it, and I listened to that thing over and over and over again. So, yeah.
I do love that version.
Mine was Cosmic Thing by the B-52s.
Ooh.
That's post Rock Lobster, right? That's more like their peak of success, B-52s, or like their come up.
That's like Love Shack.
That's like that. Yeah, it's Love Shack. It's Rome. It's Rome. Channel Z. Like, it was. Normally, my mom would like buy stuff for me when I asked her to, but it was just like a step too gay. So I had to save up my money from working construction and buy Cosmic Thing. thanks to Twitty SB on the Maximum Fun Reddit for that question. Coming up in this week's show, summer blockbusters. Will we ever be rid of the comic book movies? And can adding more diverse characters help improve ticket sales? Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. For instance, I'm all about a book that Oliver referenced before he left us for 9 months. I'm about halfway through Everything But the Burden, and it's amazing. Like, it's really, really fascinating. I mean, it's not the most current of things, but it is sort of like a really fascinating exploration of race and culture and the place of race in culture, that is very relevant, that is something that we're talking about. Like, the essay on Eminem is just fascinating. It's really good. Thanks, Oliver.
You're so welcome. I'm glad you liked it.
Margaret, what are you all about?
Well, my Facebook feed this week was lit afire by the New York Times story about how LA is the new cool place to move to if you're sick of Brooklyn. And in one way, this is a watershed moment for the New York Times because it was a story about LA that did not start with talking about traffic. So that was a huge leap forward. But in a lot of ways, it was kind of your typical New York Times style section story about LA, and that it sort of patted LA on the head and said, oh, you guys really do have things going on out there. And I think one of my favorite things about tracking this story is that there was a detail in the story about how a woman was renting an Echo Park two-bedroom apartment for $1,250. And immediately everyone was like, no way is she renting a bungalow with a yard in Echo Park for $1,250. It's not happening. And slowly over time, like give it a day, sure enough, this person is rooted out. And, you know, it turns out she was paying $1,250 her half.
Wow.
The place is $2,500
total.
What? Ooh, great expose, Wobbler.
Why is the New York Times encouraging people to come to
LA? It does matter,
LA?
Actually, though.
But right at the point in time when we're running out of water, they're suddenly saying, hey, there may be validity to your way of life.
But, you know, in the same issue, it was a Sunday issue of the Times, right? There was a different story in a different section that was basically, is California over? So clearly, whoever's working the editorial boards at the New York Times doesn't realize they're sending pretty mixed messages about the state of Los Angeles to the local
NY
flock.
But I hate when they do this because then it just starts bringing all these people here who already have like this fantasy about Los Angeles. And I thought Los Angeles was kind of getting to this place where we were starting to become a little bit more reasonable. So now we're going to bring all these irrational people here.
Well, it also hits on the way that...
filled with irrational people, but sorry.
Right, true. We don't need more.
New York is pricing itself out of being an interesting place. Like, it's getting to the point now that all of your creatives are having to go to Bushwick or Long Island City. It means that most of the people who work in Manhattan in service jobs are having to commute 2 hours from Staten Island. You know, at the point in time when every billionaire has like a beautiful like apartment built out of three apartments that they spend 2 weeks in every year, there's got to be nobody left to make this an awesome place to live.
Well, I noticed recently that my landlord has started terrorizing me more because I live in one of the like emerging neighborhoods. Hollywood has sort of been like redecorated, and now, you know, BuzzFeed is there, and one of the colleges. Emerson College is there, and they've built up all these new buildings, and I pay nothing for my apartment, and it's awesome. And he's like trying to terrorize me. And the thing is like my whole way of living is that I always try to move to the edge of the least tolerable part of the city so I can maintain under $1,000 in rent, and I'm gonna do that until I'm rich. So if you put articles like this in the New York Times, next thing you know, all these people are going to start, you know.
Well, I think that's already begun. I don't think the New York Times is inventing sort of L.A. gentrification in that respect. And I think, if anything, what we've seen happen in Manhattan and San Francisco is really just a cautionary tale for the direction that Los Angeles and many people in L.A. would love to see happen, which is rising property values, rising rental costs, because it's going to make a lot of people rich and a lot of other people who are going to get pushed out, you know, further and further from the city center.
But Oliver, the key difference is in New York or San Francisco, like, you get pushed out into the water. In L.A., you just get pushed out of water.
To the valley.
To Riverside.
Go out to the desert.
Yes. Also, let's acknowledge that while all of this was going on, Winter took off her sweater and unleashed a really amazing jumpsuit. Like, a pretty ridiculous jumpsuit.
Yeah, that's on point.
We need a photo
of. You got to see it from the back. It's ridiculous.
Oh. One more question regarding this topic. This has always been my impression, but I feel like people in L.A. allow themselves to get trolled by New Yorkers really, really too easily. That we have kind of this, we have an inferiority complex compared to New York City. So that anytime a story like this comes out, we take umbrage at it, versus if there was a story about, you know, Los Angeles being the new San Francisco, whatever, we would just shrug it off because we don't give a fuck about San Francisco. But we really care about comparisons
to New York.
Excuse
me.
LA is a hot, dumb guy and always, but very popular, but wants the guy with cool taste in music to like him. And it's just never going to happen.
I think it's partially, too, because LA just gets beat up on so much. It gets misunderstood so often that I think at this point, there's almost like a movement in LA to like correct the record to some extent.
Yes, but I honestly feel pop culture over the past 10 years has shifted its understanding of LA. I think that The New Girl and a lot of rom-coms just being shot in LA have sort of like, it used to be that it was always LA pretending to be somewhere that was more interesting. And I feel like popular media has accepted LA as a place, like Modern Family. So many TV shows are just comfortable being in LA and acknowledging it as a space. And I like it. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
Well, I was going to talk about the NBA playoffs, which are pretty amazing, especially if you happen to be a Clippers fan, which I'm not, but I'm not rooting against them right now. And the fact that they knocked off the defending champions in one of the best 7-game series in the first round in history is pretty remarkable. But this topic makes me think of the thing that I actually want to talk about is this new book that just came out called Latitudes. It's edited by Patricia Wakita. And the conceit around this, and it follows on similar books that have come out about San Francisco and New Orleans. But Wakita invited a series of writers to write essays about Los Angeles as a space and place. And then she hired a cartographer and illustrator to create an accompanying map to go with it. Cool. So I just reviewed the book for the Los Angeles Times. So, for example, there is, you know, an essay looking at, you know, a map of racial violence in Los Angeles, and another one that looks at different changing neighborhood place names in LA. And I think my favorite one is someone who he writes about the urban trees of Los Angeles, and he includes a walking tour of every single tree that's within a quarter mile of Union Station. So if you want to find like Indian laurel fig trees, you can use this map to figure out how far that is from Union Station. And really it's a way of talking about the history of foliage trends in LA that, you know, when eucalyptus trees were a big thing, that happened around like 1906 or 07, which is why we have all these highly flammable trees in a drought, you know, in a drought-ridden city. And it's just, I think it's a great way, I thought about this because of what Margaret said, but the ways in which LA is misunderstood, and each of these essays really, I think, cuts underneath those superficial layers of LA to expose histories and communities and ideas about the city that we don't typically think about, and creates it in, you know, and uses the idea of the map to give us sort of the sense of not just visualness, but also geography for how these things play out. So I think it's a fantastic approach to just thinking about how different, not a single Los Angeles, but the multiple Los Angeleses that exist here.
Sad Los Angeles fig trees, I think, are the best metaphor for this city. Like, they get enough water to survive, but never enough to actually bear fruit. It's like that guy who's still living off of that guest appearance he had on a sitcom 3 years ago. Winner, what are you all about this week?
Oh, the Met Gala. Last night was the Met Gala, which is the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art in New York. And Anna Wintour, who's the editor-in-chief of Vogue, they throw a splashy annual party. And last night was the theme was China. So they had I'm not a fashionista, so don't even get me started about trying to explain to you what the theme was and why it was thematic and all this stuff like that. It wasn't problematic. I didn't see anybody being incredibly egregious, but
still feels like a dangerous place to go. I was a little bit surprised. Like, I was worried. I mean, Sarah Jessica Parker's headpiece did veer a little bit towards chinoiserie.
It looked like an emoji. So I was all right with it. Plus, I like how they trot her out first so she can just get through the rigmarole. You know, they're going to make the jokes. And so she just, you know, shows up.
She can take the heat.
Yeah. Well, also, zing.
Her official place as our fashionista in chief. Like, the person we know will be at all of those things doing the work.
Perennial.
Never looking terrible. Talk to me about Solange.
Oh my God, she was wearing like a melted dinner plate.
Like a melted. Something tells me psychologically she was trying to sort of keep people away from her her circumference of her.
Interesting psychoanalysis there.
That's all I was doing last night. Literally, I didn't want to go to dinner because I wanted to psychoanalyze every single red carpet move.
I really like that Solange is sort of like occupying a place as one of the fashion warriors because she's not going to be successful for other things.
No, she's a great singer.
We need people on that worst dress list. And she also sometimes, her wedding, she killed it. Sometimes she kills it. Rihanna also showed up like half a batshit mess and half kind of amazing. It was like a 20-foot long bathrobe and I loved it.
I loved all the memes that went around about that, where it was like pizza.
Pizza, melting cheese.
Yeah,
eggs.
Omelets.
You know, those showy, like, you know, costumey outfits, I'm okay with to a point. It depends on who's wearing it and who can rock it. And that's why Beyonce's, you know, look, just looking at it, it looked like showgirls. It looked like showgirls. I mean, it was Nomi Malone to the hilt. But then you realize the energy that she's bringing to it. It looked fantastic compared to everybody else who was half naked. It looked fantastic. You need to have the body to work that. Mm-hmm. You need to have the prestige. You need to have the discography. You need to have all of that to work the hell out of that dress. Gravity is not defying shit in Beyonce world.
I love the idea that a discography allows you to wear certain pieces of clothing that might
not otherwise there was one photo.
It does.
I will put it on the Pop Rocket Instagram, Pop Rocket Podcast. It's one picture where she's just standing, literally like Nomi Malone emerging from that volcano, like everybody. And then I like the strategery that it goes into making your arrival because, you know, Beyonce lets everybody else show up and then makes everybody wait like 5 or 10 minutes and then posts. This was really good, like a social media strategy. She posted the outfit before on Instagram, then made the appearance. So the discussion was already happening. Mm. I mean, you have to have like restraint in that. And that's the one thing I will give Beyonce. She has restraint where she needs it. Now, everybody else who was half naked, you know, okay, I've seen that. I've seen that side of your butt. I've seen this, you know, part of your cleavage. But
you didn't like J-Lo's side butt?
I love J-Lo's side butt, but J-Lo's side butt, I've seen J-Lo's side butt.
We've seen the side butt. Come on.
We've seen the side butt, but she looked...
We've seen the whole butt.
By the way, though, J-Lo looked amazing. Kim and Kanye looked amazing. Reese Witherspoon, one of my favorites, looked amazing.
No, she looked boring as fuck. Everybody else showed up in an outfit, and she showed up looking like it was the fucking Golden Globes.
Oh.
Like, I was...
Ooh, you're saying that was such a...
She wore red.
That's a big color in China, I
that's
hear.
That's a big color in China. Katy Perry looked amazing. She
Oh, I wore a dress and I knew that China existed at the same time. No, it's the fucking Met Gala.
I'm disappointed that according to Winner, no one wore a kimono because that would have been awesome.
Don't put me on blast like that.
Somebody had to be discouraged at the last minute from putting on their kimono.
Yes, of course. But then, by the way, Naomi Campbell, just again, like, don't ever stop. Naomi, don't ever freaking stop. I mean, the woman is just a good God. She looked amazing. It's also one of those events where I really want to go. I really, really want to go. I never get FOMO, but I would just kill to be a fly on the wall. I don't know what I'd wear, though.
It was a situation that made me really sad that Fashion Police is gone and we don't know if we'll get it back. Because that was, like, after all of the award shows, like, that was our big sort of last thing of the spring season. And also, it's just so full of big choices. It's exciting and fun. And I miss having people... I just had to rely on social media for the commentary and snarking. And I got a decent amount of it, but I wanted an official place to go to get wonderful lines about it. Poor Joan. She's gone.
Yeah,
Oliver,
rest
what
in
were
peace,
you
going
to say?
Well, I'm finally seeing the Solange Knowles dress, and it reminds me of that trend in the 90s where they had those paintings where if you crossed your eyes just right, a 3D image would emerge out of it.
If you stare long enough, it looks like a better dress. Oliver, that's a funny Fashion Police joke. Let's go dig up Joan.
Oh, my God.
All right, you guys. Welcome. You're listening to podcast. We'll be right back to talk about summer blockbusters after this.
He said you just said you're listening to a podcast. Or did you say are you listening to Pop Rocket?
Oh, guy?
Okay.
Let me do
a generic podcast.
You're listening to Pop Rocket, a podcast on the internet. We'll be right back to talk about summer blockbusters after this.
Be careful what you wish for, Colin. Be careful what you wish for.
Hey, you like t-shirts, right? How about a mug? Are your walls looking a little bare? Visit MaxFunStore.com and cover all of these bases and more. We just added some amazing new shirts and posters, so visit today and outfit your home and torso with the freshest MaxFun merch. MaxFunStore.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in my apartment is...
Margaret Wappler.
And back there in the studio...
Winter Mitchell.
Oliver Wang.
So Oliver, talk to us about the summer movies.
Well, I got this idea mostly because we're both in the week, we're just past the opening weekend of Avengers Age of Ultron, which made, you know, I don't know, like $1 billion. Second highest opening, except every time they report that they never adjust for inflation. So I hate how that gets reported on. And I finally watched X-Men Days of Future Past on the flight back from Little Rock, Arkansas, which is where I was this past weekend. And it just, it's not so much that it dawned on me, but part of me just felt like this was a perfectly fine film. It's just that I am kind of bummed at the idea that every major tentpole film in every summer from here until what feels like will be the end of eternity is going to be based on either DC or Marvel property. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, and you know, cinema goes through trends, and it might be that we feel inundated by the age of the comic book movie now, but maybe, you know, 10 years from now, we'll look back on the mid-2000 teens and think, oh, that's funny that we thought, you know, comic book movies would be a thing. Or it might be that we'll be on, you know, X-Men versus Spider-Man versus, you know, Superman in 2020 instead. I don't know. Fuck, where was I going with this?
Oliver?
Yeah.
Like, I think the interesting point about what you're saying is not having our summer tentpole movies all be comic book movies. It's having them all be perfectly fine films. Like, I honestly attribute it to the Avengers franchise and the interlocking web of films that have dominated our summers for, like, the past 5 to 7 years. They're all capable movies, but none of them are that transcendent experience I'm looking for. I love a tentpole movie. I want to go and just be transported, and I feel like we're seeing so much of the same thing executed well, but it's not like the original X-Men and the first and second X-Men movies were great. They broke you out of the action movies you were used to seeing. They had kind of a great message to them. They felt gigantic. I haven't felt really transported by any of the interchangeable Thors and Captain Americas or Iron Mans that are floating around out there.
Yeah, I think those movies felt really revolutionary at first because they really championed like a certain kind of nerd culture, comic culture. It was different kinds of action heroes than you'd ever seen before. These kind of flawed characters. But now it just feels status quo. Like it used to be against the status quo. Now it's completely status quo. And I wonder if the fatigue is setting in where these movies are going to start to slow down a little bit because they're just wringing out the washcloth at this point on some of them.
The other thought that I had a second ago was that really what had to happen was special effects had to catch up with what comic books have always been portrayed for decades. And once the technology allowed us to sort of, you know, quote unquote, realize the visions that were originally put into these comic books, you know, we could have had this era 10, 15, 20 years ago, except we just didn't have the ability to sort of make it real in a way that it feels more real now. But because that technology now exists and you can't put that back, you know, you can't put it back in Pandora's box, that's part of my concern that people would just keep churning these things out over and over. And God, I mean, there's, you know, what, 80 years of comics that we could mine for material. It just feels kind of potentially exhausting. But I think Winter's got a point here.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, like, if you watch Richard Donner's Superman, I don't think anybody has, because now we've been conditioned with movies, I don't think anybody born maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, has the patience for Dick Donner's Superman. I mean, it's you don't see Superman for like 45 minutes up to an hour before you actually see Superman.
And the charm of that movie is not the beams that come out of his eyes.
No.
The charm of that movie is his, like, his interplay with his parents, his interplay
origin
with Lois Lane. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Krypton looks kind of cool, but it's mostly just sort of people hanging off of wires. And it has been interesting to see those times when we basically, like with Green Lantern, when you got a movie that was just so removed to a green screen that it was like a Star Wars prequel. It was unrooted. There was nothing human or fun about it. It was just...
But they make these movies for fans. They make them because the fans demand it. Ryan Reynolds is only Deadpool because the fans are like, he's the only person that can be Deadpool. Okay, there's probably like 40 other...
He was really good as Deadpool. But that's also me not all white menning. All right, let's talk about this. These movies are just different mix and models of straight white guy. Like, it is just... Well, look, there's so much diversity. We have a wry, slightly older one and a beefier Australian one playing a Norse god. Are we going to get an actual black superhero?
Black Panther.
Like someone from the canon. Okay, when is that happening?
Yeah, that's what I put. It got pushed back for another fucking Spider-Man. And it's like, I don't need another I'm done with Spider-Man. I am 100% done with his girlfriends. I'm sorry about your uncle. I'm done with your story. I don't care anymore about it. Your villains are weird. Sandman, they're all, you know, the octopus. I don't care about any of that stuff. Iron Man, I don't know. I love Robert Downey Jr. So I'm okay with Iron Man because his suit is so dope. His suit is so dope.
But in the last one, they had like 30 of those things that you just looked at and they broke. The Iron Man suit has lost all of its mystique.
Well, it was being mass produced. That was the whole thing. No. I would love to see a black female villain.
Okay, first let's address the fact that if you're building up your fake world, you have to comport with the rules of your fake world, and you cannot tell us how amazing and rare and powerful the Iron Man suit is and then make there be a bunch of them, because it's screwing with your own world. And let's talk about female superheroes. We're only allowed to have them on a team of people where there are a bunch of superheroes. Mm. And there's talk of a Wonder Woman movie finally happening. But I am worried that it's being done with a hot, boring girl, and in the way that we make movies for men, as opposed to having it be somebody who feels like she's awesome in her own rights.
I can tell just from looking at her, she has like zero charisma of a Linda Carter.
Who is this? It's the cast, what's her name from?
Gal.
Oh, right. She was in the Fast and Furious films.
The Fast
right?
and Furious yeah. films. So, like, I, you know, Wonder Woman, also, I hate when they make.
Gal
them, like,
means
dark.
Wave in Hebrew.
Well, didn't they just have an upset with Wonder Woman where they had a female, I want to say like a female screenwriter, and she's already left because
why do I think it was Patty Jenkins? Who might have been directing, and then they either took her off or they put her on. I'm sorry, guys. We should do more research before we do our podcast.
I know. I'm trying to dial this into my phone. Right
it's really hard. It's so hard to believe with how many women there are in executive positions in film, but it really is a very, like, the inertia of patriarchy, the inertia of dudes being like, yeah, nobody's going to want to see that.
I don't think I think it's shifting though, because the story I heard on NPR this weekend was about how kids are, the sales are going up for comic books because they've been introducing more diverse characters.
I mean, that's how the audiences are reacting. But what was the story? Independence Day, like Meg Whitman or May Whitman?
May
Whitman.
So rude this is.
Yeah, she played the president's daughter in the original film. She's now a successful and very well-respected
And not on drugs child star. I mean,
film actress,
there you go.
And they're not going to cast her because she has to be hot enough to get a Hemsworth. And we cannot imagine that this very, very beautiful woman is the person who can be at the heart of a movie. And that's so sad, and it's so narrow. And I feel like these movies are going to, like, choke on their own overgrowth if they just keep this very limited view of who can make shit happen.
But to come back to my original question, is this going to be a permanent feature of summer blockbusters from here until
no,
the end
one
of time?
Has to make one has one of them has to perform really terribly. Do we need an ID4? I don't really think so. A sequel. No, we don't really need one. And the other thing, too, is you have to realize is like most of these studios, they're betting on against huge budgets against getting all that money back. And when you can get a movie to open a week before it opens internationally, before it gets domestically, and then have it make all this money, now you've already covered the marketing budget, and then you can just cover it with domestic, the production costs. I mean, like, you're gonna do it. I mean, it's sort of a way for the movie industry to sort of pad themselves so they can do the really, you know, nice, sweet indie movies, or take a risk on, you know, dick and fart movies that Apatow makes.
They don't do that as much. And because it is so much about international box office, I do wonder if it will take shifting tastes from, like, international markets. I mean, the thing we learned, one of the amazing things we got from the Sony leak was just execs being honest about Denzel Washington's international box office. And, like, you know, that's clearly got to be one of the concerns. One of the reasons we haven't seen anyone but a white male superhero. And does it take, like, Europe, Japan, and China changing what they're interested in watching to shift what we get as our summer blockbusters?
But we have the control, and we should be able to do that. We can do that. One of the worst stories I've ever heard since being in this business is how Will Smith fired a publicist because he told his publicist, like, this is probably like late early OOs, like early aughts, how he wanted to be, you know, more visible on in media internationally. Instead of like doing talk shows, he wanted to be like in magazines, you know, stuff that was going to get traded around and passed around. And they told him, like, you'll never get a cover. You're a black man. You'll never get a cover. I mean, he's at that point, he's really Will Smith. So, the first thing that has to happen is people have to accept that he's a big star. Denzel Washington is a big star. There are big stars in America who are African-American. We don't get sort of like pushed out to other countries and presented that way. He doesn't get $10 million commercials in Japan, you know?
One problem that I have is that our reboot cycle has gone from being like 15 or 20 years to like 10, that we're starting up with a brand new Spider-Man's over and over again. Are there any superhero franchises that we haven't made movies out of that you would like to see?
I don't have much faith that this new Fantastic Four reboot's going to be any good. Ugh. But I don't understand how they can't make this into a better film series than it is. Partly, I don't know what's going on with the casting, but this is sort of the foundational Marvel family. They have a compelling villain in Doctor Doom. They have, you know, a nice quartet of different personalities, and which diversely cast. You saw that Johnny Blaze is now mm-hmm. played by, I forget what's
Michael
the actor's
B.
name.
Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, that's right. So that's okay. So they're playing with the casting a little bit, but the movie doesn't, like, this based on the trailer, it doesn't look good, and I just can't figure out how they can't get the Fantastic Four right or just well, you know.
Yeah.
So
sometimes they just push these out, you know, though, to move the origin story to the story they really want to get to.
Maybe.
But it's like doing the easy questions first on the SATs and leaving the hard ones till the end.
No, but you can't charge me $15 for that. You
true,
need to
true.
Make if you're making a summer blockbuster movie, I want something big and tentpole. And I only asked that question about a franchise you wanted to see because I would pay $1,000 to watch a She-Hulk movie. She's
okay, now you're talking.
She's
yes!
a lawyer.
Wow.
She's a lawyer.
The allegories right there. Okay.
Who would be a good She-Hulk?
Crushing for the law.
Who would be a good She-Hulk? That lady who plays Brienne of Tarth on Game of Thrones. She's gigantic.
Oh God, I've never seen Game
of Thrones. Well, the Hulk's it's all CGI, so you just need to be able to cast the, you know, the Bruce Banner equivalent of the She-Hulk in terms of.
Well, no, She-Hulk lives her entire life as a
Catherine. Keener.
No, She-Hulk
That's
lived
an interesting pick.
She-Hulk lives her entire life as She-Hulk.
Oh.
But she's always in she's always in control of, like, her intentions and stuff. And she's only as 70% as strong as the Hulk. So there are some feminist issues in She-Hulk.
I would like them to remake Superman 3.
Can I tell you guys the summer movie that I'm excited about that has something to do with anyone wearing a uniform?
Tell
it's,
us. Yes.
It's Paul Blart Train too? Wreck. It's Trainwreck.
Yes.
Amy Schumer's Trainwreck. That's the tentpole movie for me.
Yeah, because we got into, almost in the way that we did with the superhero movies, we got into this model of comedy that we were letting Judd Apatow be in charge of all of our comedies. And
he's in charge of this one, too.
In charge of this one, too. But like,
yeah, I was going to say, isn't he working on this one?
Bridesmaids did like push the like the mold a lot. And I think that this movie will push the mold a lot. And I mean, he's so capable. He's amazing. But like, infusing it with new energy. God knows I loved all those Seth Rogen movies. I still love all of those Seth Rogen, James Franco movies. But it's going to be awesome to let Amy Schumer just go crazy.
I just like I want to see a messy girl be the lead. Somebody who's messy.
That sounds like Amy Schumer.
Yeah, that's like you know, self-assured. Yes, like, you know, I will get up and go to work. I will be there somewhat on time. I will try, you know, occasionally to eat healthy. But otherwise, I'm just generally messy. Like, you know, somebody that reflects most of America.
A real comedian. A real comedian, not a pretty girl who's in rom-coms. God knows I love so many of them. But, like, realize to yourself that we never gave Sarah Silverman a comedy that was hers. Like, she's that beautiful and that talented, and she was still playing the less attractive friend in romantic comedies.
And she was so shrill in Rock of Ages, or no, School of Rock. I hated her character in that. It was just
like, she's commented on how annoyed she got with roles that were essentially just putting your hand on your hip and telling men children not to go be men children. Like, those were the roles that were there for her.
I'm honestly waiting for someone to get her and get her like she should be gotten, because she's been underused and underserved for so long. Like, she looks fantastic. Thank God she's using the milk of magnesia on her face. She looks so young and youthful that if they're worried about aesthetics, it doesn't matter. She looks fantastic. But she, I would love to see her like in a really great dramatic role. I would love to see
her. She has an HBO pilot that is like a rich, interesting dramedy that I really hope will go.
I just wish she'd get every role that Kristen Wiig gets. And I like Kristen Wiig, but there's something about Sarah Silverman that she just doesn't get enough play. Like, I would like to see her in Trainwrecked. I like Amy Schumer, but Amy Schumer's so farty. And Sarah Silverman is like, she's going to fart after you leave the room, you know?
All right, everybody, let's just, what's your like signature definitive summer tentpole movie that defines your experience?
American Pie. I go and see American Pie anytime there's, and Jackass for that matter. I like escapist stuff and I like silly, gross out humor because I'm like and secretly a 14-year-old boy. So anytime American Pie movies come out or any Jackass movies come out, I love that shit.
Oliver.
Oh, I hate these questions because I'm trying to. I have to sort through sort of a increasingly deteriorating memory to figure out. So, what films came out in the summertime, and like, what qualifies as a summer film?
Back to the Future.
No, I mean, I would say of something that's come in the last 20 years, maybe probably ID4. I mean, I remember watching it when it first came out, and I didn't think it was like a masterpiece. It was just incredibly watchable. Like, mm-hmm. It was a really fun film. And then every time it's come back on television. It's one of those things where if it's on TV and you end up in the middle of it, you'll just kind of sit and finish it because why not? You know, it goes down easy.
It didn't hold
respect.
Up for me recently. Oh. It was just, it looked really like saturated and it looked like a bad filter on an Instagram video and I just had to turn it off. It was all stretched across my television. But I remember that it cost $6.75. I remember that exactly, that it was $6.75 to see Independence Day
Margaret,
or ID4.
Definitive summer blockbuster.
Well, I don't know if this counts as a summer blockbuster, but for some reason, immediately what came to mind was Splash. Because I think that's the first movie I saw as a kid that I absolutely loved. And it had this big, summery, like just huge comedy. We were talking about that last show, like those great 80s comedies that had like ridiculous concepts and they just totally went for it. And I feel like Mermaids, where are they now? I would love to see another Mermaid movie.
Well, you're getting what is his name? Sea Guy? Who's the sea guy, the Marvel
Aquaman?
Aquaman, you're getting him. So you get a merman.
No,
she wants mermaid. Mermaid.
No, yeah, mermaid.
Merman is Namor the Submariner. Hello.
Oh,
yes.
DC is Aquaman.
I mean, I need like blonde crimped hair. I need turquoise, iridescent. Like, this is what I'm talking
about.
Well,
we get into those things of like, we have vampires for 10 years and then we get witches back. And I'm excited that I think we're getting witches back. But mermaids, let's bring them.
Yeah.
And I asked this question and it was stupid, but I don't even know if this came out in the summertime, but like, I just think about being a kid and going and seeing The Last Starfighter and just having that thing of like this gigantic movie that like took you to another place. And like, I feel like Guardians of the Galaxy approached that, but wasn't. It still didn't bust my brain open as much as Jupiter Ascending did. And that was a terrible movie.
What about Jurassic Park?
You know that I have never seen Jurassic Park.
Oh, sorry.
Two people.
You didn't miss anything. You really didn't
Jurassic
miss anything.
World. Oh, Jurassic World is coming out, though.
I like Chris Pratt, too. I have to say, I'm insane. The obvious answer to the question is Star Wars. If we're going to be definitive. But it's also
you
like,
weren't here. We covered that,
that's
Oliver.
Like low-hanging fruit. I'm sorry. You guys talked about Star Wars?
Yes, we did, boo.
You talked about the Oh, man.
Sorry, boo.
It wasn't a flattering
I'm okay without a Transformers movie this week this year, too.
Yeah, thank God.
God, those movies are so terrible and interchangeable and have no magic, and I hate them. All right, you guys.
How do you really feel?
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
Hi, everybody. I'm Justin McElroy.
And I'm Dr. Sydney McElroy.
Every Tuesday, we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine, a show about all the dumb, weird, terrible ways that we've tried to fix each other over the years. You know, some light summer listening.
Maybe you want to hear about yogurt enemas, or why we tried to eat mummies for a while, or why drinking cholera diarrhea sounded like a good idea.
That and so much more is waiting for you every Tuesday right here on the Maximum Fun Network with Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket, you guys. Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask that age-old question, what's your current jam? All right, winner, what's your jam?
Oh, so one of our lovely, lovely tweeters, reminded me of the song when because I did the song last week, the jam from last week, which Colin, you know, refuses to switch over to a U.S. Spotify account for some crazy economic reason. So it's Friendly Fire's song called Hurting. It's from 2011. But I love the song, and they reminded me that they liked this, you know, the song that I picked last week because it reminded them of this song. And I actually love this song. So I just wanted to hear it again. I've been playing it lately, and I forgot how much I loved it. I love the lead singer's voice. It comes in here in a little bit. I really love songs where they sound like they're three or four different genres in one. So this is a really good one. Great to put on and to start off a party.
No, that's...
God,
what? It's such a fun, like, junior, senior-y, erasure-y, falsettos and synthesizers magic.
80s. Love it. Thank you. That seems like a vote of confidence. I'm going to take that guy.
All right. Do you need to leave?
Yeah.
All right, we love you.
Love you, too.
Bye-bye.
I miss you guys. I missed you, too, Oliver. I know it doesn't sound like it, but I miss you.
No.
Oliver, what is your jam?
I'm going to continue the 80s theme. So I could not tape with you guys last week because I was DJing a wedding out in Little Rock, Arkansas. Shouts out to Tommy and Randall. They gave me a long list of songs that the bride specifically, Randall, wanted to hear. And one of them was Beyonce's Love on Top, which I had completely slept on when it first came out on the 4 album. And it is this delicious new edition meets like mid-70s funky boogie R&B, you know, just kind of this melange of different styles crammed into one and then done by Beyonce. And I've been listening to the song nonstop ever since I saw it on her list of requests, and I'm like, this is a great song. How did I miss this song
so
the first time out? So yeah, it's very like 1984 meets 1976, and you know, B did a really great job with this. I felt foolish for not having really sat with it back when it first came out, because I think it came out
Did you properly experience Countdown?
No, probably not then.
Okay, Countdown is also on 4. 4 is an amazing album. I wasn't a huge fan of Beyoncé's self-titled album.
Countdown, yes, no, I do know that one.
Countdown is... like those two songs are back to back on that album, and it's too much goodness in one place. Excellent choice, Oliver.
Thank you.
Margaret, what's your jam?
My jam is Hot Chips Need You Now. This is an album, or this is a cut from their album that's coming out in a couple of weeks. And I love these guys. They're a British electronica band. They've been going at it for quite some time now. And I have a special soft spot for moody dance tracks in particular. So let's hear a little bit of it.
I want a martini all of a sudden.
I know, it's sleek.
Some like Ace Hotel rooftop party jam right here.
So yeah, that's from their sixth album, Why Make Sense. And again, I think there's something really interesting about a band when they've been going at it for a bit of time. Like number 6 for a band like this is something to get to. And I find that they're still inventive. They're still deeply invested. Like you listen to their record and you can tell they're still like committed to it and thinking of new ideas. And yeah, so hats off to them.
I mean, I feel like in entertainment, it's so hard to find people who have been at something and good at something for a long time and are still trying, but who have not been successful enough that they just stop trying and roll around in money. It's like there's something lovely about that sweet spot of having gifted professionals who really know what they're doing and are still working hard at it.
Yeah, they've been hovering at this certain level for a while now that's like definitely, you know, Coachella level fame, like, you know, second stage level fame.
We're all second stagers out there.
Right.
And my jam comes from our sister podcast here at Maximum Fun, Lady to Lady. They are three comics who host a podcast that is like the most delightful slumber party you've ever been to. I've been a guest on it a couple of times. Like, they talk about their lives and politics and pop culture and all sorts of good stuff like that. But they're going on a tour of a bunch of cities. And so I want you guys to listen to this. And if they're coming near you, you should go see them, because Barbara, Tess, and Brandy are three of my favorite people on the planet. And you guys need to love them. And Margaret and Winter should be guests on the show. And Oliver, you could be the guest man, but that's you only get to come in at the end of the show.
Okay.
All right, let's listen to it.
Hey, everybody. It's Barbara from the Lady to Lady podcast.
And Brandy, also from the Lady to Lady podcast.
What?
Ooh.
We are going on a tour in the Pacific Northwest starting May 11th, and we're coming to a bunch of cities. Where are we going?
We're going to Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, Salem, Oregon, Eureka, California, Oakland, California, Ventura, California, and stopping at the tour in Los Angeles at the UCB Sunset on May 23rd.
Ooh, and I just think you can get your tickets and info at ladytoladycomedy.com.
You are correct, Barb.
Wow. Let's go get our tickets now, and we'll see you out there.
So they are cool, and they are great, and you should go see them if you're in the Pacific Northwest or California. You guys, you have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with...
Oliver Wang.
Margaret Wappler.
And Winter Mitchell, who had to leave. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Kara P and Ari G for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us, people. It's only been 2 reviews. We need more reviews, you guys. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket or join our Facebook group. This week, tell us, what was the first album you bought with your own money as a child or teen? We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the very patient Colin Anderson. I think I've used patient before.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.